Okay, as we begin this class, do any of you have any further questions on what we were discussing last time? Because I know there were quite a lot of questions there. That is the whether indeed Christianity has had any serious impact on Western culture. Rob? Well, I think the... Now, that's an interesting question. Were there non-Christians who were in agreement with Schaeffer's view on the influence of Christianity on the West and on the United States in particular? Because certainly he was hammered by quite a few evangelicals. You're quite right there. Now, I think one of the things that Oz was saying the other day, in terms of his work on the Williamsburg Charter, they have many non-Christians working with them on that who were quite happy to recognize that the history of this country could not be understood without seeing the influence of Christianity upon it. And the fact that that has now been adopted by several states for their whole educational curriculum in the public schools means that there must be a recognition out there of the influence of Christianity. But I think if you read any serious study on the development of the New England states, for example, it would be impossible for it to be accurate historically without speaking about the influence of a Christian understanding. I remember reading a little book on the New England colony by a Marxist historian, and he just took it for granted that it was impossible to understand the history of the New England colonies without seeing that Christian foundation. Now, he didn't agree with it, but just as a historian, he didn't agree with the Christian position, but just as a historian, he recognized that. I think what you've got to remember is that we've gone through a period of, say, 20 or 30 years when, as part of the reaction to Christianity, people in every discipline have tried to either malign or to de-emphasize the influence of Christianity on the development of this nation or of Western Europe. But I think if you read almost any history book from before 30 or 40 years ago, you would find it just simply taken for granted that that was the reality, both by those who were Christians and by those who weren't. It would be the same in the history of science. It is very widely acknowledged that modern science as we know it has arisen within the context of a Christian understanding of reality. Now, I think we have this, if you like, sort of hiatus of a period of 30 years or so of denying that influence of Christianity. And many of the younger evangelical historians who've attacked Schaeffer have been trained during that period. Hopefully in the future there will be a return to a more balanced position in terms of acknowledging the past. You see, as I said the other day, you don't need to say everybody was a Christian. You don't need to say every individual who had, say, an influence on the shaping of America was individually a Christian. What we're talking about is a consensus and the historical moment in which they lived. It's really such a foolish thing to suggest it has no influence. It would be like looking at Saudi Arabia and saying Islam has had no influence upon it. And nobody would say such a thing. You know, it's very evident that the worldview of a people shapes its institutions. It's a very modern idea that religion and reality have nothing to do with each other. That's something which in the past, until a very short time ago, nobody would have recognized as even a possible idea. So it's not a strange thing to be saying. It just appears strange at this moment in history where faith is put into a completely separate compartment. But I think if you read Weber and Tawney on the history of capitalism, both of them acknowledge very clearly the influence of Christianity on the development of the whole economic system, quite apart from anything else. And those are foundational books. I think the question is, you know, how many people in the, if you like, in the secular academic world recognize the importance of Schaeffer or would be prepared to say he had any influence, positive or otherwise. I can't really answer that question. I think you'll find that there are a growing number of studies of his influence, both within the Christian community and outside it. But again, you've got to remember the moment in which we live, that our culture has moved so strongly in the direction of separating Christianity or separating religion from every other aspect of reality, that isn't a natural source of study at the present time. Though perhaps that will begin to change a little bit. I think it will be interesting to see over the next 20 years just how many studies there are that will be done, both within the evangelical community and outside. I get regularly telephone calls and letters from people who are doing doctoral studies and MA theses on Schaeffer. Those are Christians mostly, yes.
Are they in Christian institutions?
No. No, they're not in Christian institutions. You know, many of them are, I mean, they're mostly in ordinary universities where they're doing that work. And for them to be able to do that, there must be some recognition by their professors that this is worth studying. Any other questions here before we move on? Yeah, Robert. Mhm. Mhm. Yes. That's a good question. The question is, is it possible that thinking about the influence of Christianity on the economic system of capitalism in the West, is it possible that Christianity was misused sometimes as an ideology for practical purposes? Yes, it certainly is. And of course that was Karl Marx's basic approach, to say that religion, particularly Christianity in Western Europe and the United States, was what he called the opium of the people, that it was ruthlessly used as an ideology by those in economic power to keep ordinary working people working hard, holding before them the fear of judgment, holding before them an ordered view of the universe in which they had to keep their place on the bottom of the pile, just to prevent them from rebelling against the system. And, you know, that is, if you like, been a sort of piece of Marxist dogma from Marx right up till the present time, for a period of 150 years. Now, of course there's an element of truth in that, in that there are always politicians and people in power who are prepared to use the convictions of people for their own purposes, whether it's to be elected, whether it's to stay in power, or whatever. We talked about this a little the other day, how President Nixon, for example, was constantly appealing to people's Christianity at the end of his speeches. Now, where exactly he stands, I don't know, but I personally, as a non-American, had a real problem with that, hearing him do that, because on the one hand, he was known for doing things which were clearly illegal, and yet at the same time, he was appealing to people's Christian commitment. And there's a kind of double message you're getting there. Doing things illegal and dishonest, and or at least having other people do them. I suppose I have to be careful about what I say here. Robert will wipe out what ought not to be here. So, of course, Christianity can be misused as an ideology to maintain order in a society or to maintain a certain economic situation. There's a funny little prayer in England which expresses this: God bless the squire and his relations, and may he keep us in our stations. Where that little prayer was a humorous response by ordinary English people to the way the church was sometimes seen as the preserver of the status quo and just keeping people where they were. That is always going to be a reality. You can see in the Muslim world at the present time how religious fervor, religious conviction, can be appealed to by those in power. Even Saddam Hussein does that, though he's been busy building a secular state. When it serves his purposes, he appeals to Islam. Now, that can be true in any context, whether in a context where Christianity has been the consensus or Islam or whatever. But I think we have to examine the question a little more deeply. Notice that I said appealing to the convictions of people. You can only really appeal to a religious view, even if you're doing it for pragmatic and ideological purposes, if it really is the views of people. You can distort it and misrepresent it in order to keep things as they are, in order to, let's say, suppress any kind of change, but only by appealing to the fact that people do have these convictions about who God is and who they are before God, and that his word is to be obeyed. So even that argument recognizes that the consensus of opinion was a Christian one. Otherwise, even the unscrupulous politician wouldn't have been making that kind of appeal. But over against that view, I would say this, that, again, as you look back at the history of Western Europe and the United States, Christianity has been a major force for change. While it can be used by those who want to keep things the way they are, it has actually been a major force for change. If we just use some examples from Britain, in the 19th century, it was Christian convictions that were the major force behind almost all the major social changes, whether it was the abolition of slavery, the changing of labor conditions in the factories, the improvement of prison conditions, the beginning of what we might call modern nursing, or on many of these issues, it was Christians who were in the forefront of change because of their Christian convictions. It's a really false reading of history to see Christianity always something being used by unscrupulous politicians to keep things the way they are. Of course, you can find examples of that. Or if you look back at the Civil War in England in the 17th century, I'm more at home speaking about the British situation than the American one, but looking at the Civil War in England in the 17th century, there's no way you can understand that without seeing the way Cromwell and the parliamentarians were completely shaped by their understanding of Scripture, which brought about radical changes in British society. If you see that film on Cromwell's life, for example, with Richard Harris, even though it presents him warts and all, that film recognizes very clearly that the whole of the British future is completely indebted to Cromwell for his putting restraints on the power of the monarchy and introducing a parliamentary form of government. And those people did that because of their Christian convictions. You don't have to approve of everything Cromwell did, let's say with regard to the Irish, for example, where I certainly wouldn't approve of what he did, to recognize that, in fact, British history owes him an enormous debt. And you don't have to be a Christian to recognize that. I think most British historians or historians of Britain would recognize that his work had an enormous impact on the development of Britain and its whole understanding of the nature of law, of the nature of power, of restraints on those in power, those kinds of issues. And remember, that's at the very time when the Westminster Assembly was meeting, producing the Westminster Confession. I mean, those people who were involved in that revolution were people who were the most strongly committed to the Reformed faith. The point I made the other day about Jeremy Rifkin was that he, as a non-Christian, was acknowledging that the major social changes in the United States were because of Christianity. But in fact, it hasn't really been a force for conservatism in that kind of sense of just keeping the status quo. I think at the moment we're in a rather different position. The Christians at the moment are seen as a force of conservatism because of the stand Christians are taking on moral issues like abortion and the family and pornography. And those are seen as conservative issues at the moment. And of course, in one sense, they are, because they're seeking to conserve the view of the family, of human life, of sexuality, which has been taken for granted in this culture for several hundred years. And that is appears to be very conservative at the moment. But if you look at it another way, it's a very radical position, a kind of revolutionary position, because it's exactly the opposite of what the dominant culture is saying at the present time. But I think there is very little force to simply explaining the influence of Christianity historically on unscrupulous people in power. I think that the lie to Marx's whole approach is the debacle economically you see in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union right now, and comparing it with a situation here. Well, certainly there is a situation which is not filled, where you can find many examples of injustice, where you can find many examples of poverty and suffering. But to look at this society and say that here capitalism in relationship to Christianity has been a tool for keeping people down, keeping people enslaved, keeping them in poverty, is clearly nonsense. It's clearly nonsense. You know, I think you can demonstrate that it's only where people are given some sense of economic significance, because they have some significance before God, and the two are fundamentally related, that our lives count, that the choices we make matter, they make a difference, that we are accountable for what we do, that we have the possibility of changing our situation, that you are going to have both social changes and economic advancement. You see, Christianity is the very opposite of a conservative force in that sense, because Christianity comes to the individual and promises them liberation. It promises them a new relationship with God. It calls them to a new kind of obedience, which is going to transform their life. And while it may seem at a superficial glance to be conservative in the sense that it requires respect for authority, fundamentally it's a source for the most dramatic social change. And you can predict that in any country where there is any kind of genuine Christian revival, it's going to transform the whole society over time, because it changes the way people see each other. It changes the relationship, for example, between master and servant, or employee and employee, employer and employee immediately. As soon as somebody begins to see that it's not power that matters, it's not money that matters, it's not privilege that matters, it's not what strata of the society you're born into that matters, it's who you are before God that matters, that is a profound instrument of social change right there, because it enables people to see themselves differently. If you take India as an example, with its caste system, I think we would have to say that if there were, it'd be interesting how you would respond to this, Paul, that if there were a genuine Christian revival in that society and masses of people converted, that over time the caste system would have to go. It's so intimately related to Hinduism it's so completely alien to a Christian understanding that in Christ there is no caste, we might say, using that context, that it would be bound to produce changes, as it led to the abolition of slavery, let's say in Britain, or here eventually. Because of what?
Of a revival?
Yeah. Oh, it's a good question. Do I see the possibility of capitalism changing because of a revival? Yeah. Carefully note what I'm saying. I'm not saying that capitalism itself is Christian, or that the form in which capitalism is practiced at the present time or at any point in the past is faithfully obedient to the gospel. That's not the point that I'm making. What I'm saying is there are some fundamental elements in Christian teaching, in Christian doctrine, which transform the way we see ourselves and the way we see society, and which over time make people productive. They really do. People see, you know, Oz kept speaking about the Christian doctrine of calling, which is fundamental to any understanding of the Reformation, that Calvin taught, and Calvin most strongly, but also Luther, but Calvin in particular taught, that every human person has dignity before God. And that every calling, whether I'm a baker or a butcher or a farmer or a merchant, or I'm a nurse or a teacher or whatever I am, that my calling is to serve God in everything I do. That there is no place of service which is beneath the dignity of the believer. And that my calling then is to devote myself, to set my life apart, and what I do in my workplace and everywhere else, to the service of God. Now that transforms the way you see yourself. And one may say that there are elements of capitalism which are profoundly related to a Christian understanding of the human person and human responsibility. Now, we have to acknowledge as well that there are other elements of capitalism as it's practiced, which are more closely related to human sin. If you look at most of the corporate takeovers which take place right now in the United States, I heard the Chancellor of Denver University one day saying on the radio that 98% of all corporate takeovers have no concern whatsoever for the company that's taken over, but simply for the power and wealth of the individual who takes them over. Now, or you can think of the Harvard Business School at the present time being so distressed by the total breakdown of ethics within the stockbroking community that it has put millions of dollars into a foundation to try to find a basis to teach ethics to businessmen and women. Because we're really in a serious situation right now. Because for the non-Christian in our culture, the primary moral value for people is, as Schaeffer said, personal peace and affluence. And for many Christians, there is a view of life where God's word doesn't touch my business life, because that's secular. It's not part of my sacred calling. Christians haven't been salt and light in this area, with a few notable exceptions. So we're in a situation where there's a radical breakdown within the business community. What you have is a capitalism in that situation, which then just simply gives in to human sin, to greed, to power, to privilege, etc. It's no longer restrained by a sense of responsibility to the society or a sense of obligation. Let me give an illustration from England. Just before I came over here, I heard the heads of one of our major stockbroking companies in Britain say, "I am looking for young men and women who are ruthless, greedy, and aggressive." He said this on television. "Those are the people I want to work for me." Now, obviously, if you're looking for people like that, the amount of corruption in the business community, the amount of just what might be called the unacceptable face of capitalism in the sense of just untrammeled greed, and we see a lot of it in the savings and loan industry right at the moment in terms of its collapse, is going to increase more and more. But what Christianity brings to what we might say capitalism is several things. First, it brings this sense of individual accountability and responsibility before God. and the sense of freedom the individual has before God, so I can really make something of my life. I don't have to stay doing the same thing my family has done for generations. I have the possibility of really going out and exploring and understanding and exercising dominion over the world. Many pagan religions in particular do not allow people to affect their environment at all, because the environment itself is seen to be dominated by spirits. You can't change anything. I have a friend who works in Africa, in Kenya, with a very impoverished tribe of people who have plenty of resources to make their life less impoverished, but their religious view keeps them in complete captivity to the situation. They would be offending against the spirits of their ancestors, against the spirits of the land in which they live, if they were to change anything, if they were to have a more efficient agriculture. Well, Christianity comes into such a situation with a tremendously liberating message. You are not bound by such things. You exist before God. You are called by God to have dominion over your environment, to set back the bounds of the fall. That's a very dramatic message. But what Christianity and what that will create in any situation is what we might say the beginnings of a capitalist economy. Yeah. But what Christianity also contributes is some other things which are equally important. The first is a sense of moral accountability to God. That my, let's say, use of the environment, my employment of other people, is ruled by God's standards of justice and righteousness. So as Paul says to the masters, you're going to have to give an account to God one day for what you're doing. That will be another fundamental element which Christianity will contribute to this discussion. A third will be a sense of stewardship. That with regard, let's say, to the environment, the Christian won't simply abuse and dominate the environment, exploit it. One sees one has a sense of responsibility for future generations and ultimately before God. It's spelled out very clear in the Old Testament law, where you have both the element of dominion. Here God gives the people of Israel a land which has gold and copper in the hills, which can be dug out, a land which is fertile, a land where they can irrigate their pastures, etc. They're going to change the environment. That's what dominion means. But at the same time, they're given it in trust by God for future generations. They are required to take care of it. And the whole system of agriculture, as it's laid out in the Old Testament, requires care for the land. The fields themselves are given a sabbatical break. And modern farming now knows that that's necessary, actually, for the land itself to be replenished. And where there is a return to what's called sustainable agriculture today, there is a recognition that letting land lie fallow is essential if you're going to make it productive forever and ever and ever. So there's that third element there, which is a sense of stewardship before God, that this is his land, which he has given us in trust, which is not simply mine to make money of, but has to be passed on to the next generation so they can make their living from it too. And you can think of the Jubilee laws in the Old Testament and so on. That's a third element. A fourth element is what Schaeffer used to call the compassionate use of accumulated wealth, when he was talking about the bounds that Christianity sets on capitalism. But we might just call it simply mercy. Fundamental to the Old Testament law, when it's talking, let's say, to the business person, which in that context was a farmer, was the requirement to be merciful to the poor and to share what one has with the stranger and with the widow and the orphan. And in other words, the Christian doesn't see what I have, the money I produce by my hard work, which I'm right to do before God, and the idea of profit is not wrong. Paul says the hard-working farmer deserves a share of the crops. It's a thoroughly biblical principle that if I put something in, I ought to expect something back. And that's the way God has created the world. But the Christian doesn't then say, what I have is mine, it's mine completely, because that's like the rich man who said, soul, you've built your barns, take your ease and be satisfied. The Christian sees themselves before God as having a responsibility to care for the needs of their fellow human beings. So that right sense of productivity, of profit from my labor, is tempered by a sense of obligation to my fellow human beings who may have less than I do. And again, wherever you see Christianity really being lived out in practice, it has that effect. And I would say there are still some elements of that in this society as a whole, even though it's moved so far from Christianity. The reason so many of these charities can gain vast amounts of money is that there is still what Solzhenitsyn called vast reserves of mercy and sacrifice, which still is seen as a fundamental part of humanity in this culture, even by people who most of the time think about themselves only. But there is still something there to appeal to. There is still a memory. There is still a memory of that calling to show compassion for the needs of one's fellow human beings. So that whenever you have one of these telethons raising money for something, they will raise money, vast, vast amounts of it, whether it's for famine in some other part of the world or whatever it is. People are responsive. And part of that is still a memory of that Christian gospel which calls people to give as God has given to us. But there are all sorts of ways in which in which we might say capitalism is constrained or restrained by Christian doctrine. Another I would want to add is this, and really I've mentioned it already, but let's express it more carefully. I don't think the Christian can ever be for what's called laissez-faire capitalism. That is capitalism which is completely uncontrolled. If you look in the Old Testament law again, you see that business is never left alone because God recognizes that people are sinful. And therefore there are standards of justice which God applies to the business community, and which a government has the calling to apply today. If you say, well, we will have no restraints whatsoever on the market, in a sinful world, you guarantee that there's going to be exploitation and oppression, unless every individual is a really devout believer. Well, every individual isn't. And believers too need the restraints of the law, sadly. It ought not to be like that, but they do. You know, Paul says to the Christians in Romans 13, you know, obey the laws, but not just out of fear, but out of conscience sake. But often in our situation, we're in a situation where there's been so little teaching about conscience in the business community, in our churches, that you have Christian businessmen obeying the law out of fear rather than out of conscience sake. And that's terrible that we should be able to say that. That could be a reality. But there does need to be restraints. There is restraints in every area by the law of God because of the recognition of human sin. Now, is there a real alternative either to capitalism or socialism? I mean, is there a third alternative? Yes. A placebo, yes. Yeah, that's a good question. Is there a real alternative? Because capitalism, the question is, seems so bound up with money or profit being the end, whereas the heart of Christianity is that the worship of God and the enjoyment of Him is the end. That's a good question. I think again, though, we have to ask the question, in what context did capitalism arise historically? It arose within a context where the chief end was God. Now, what our calling to do as Christians is, you see, capitalism is simply a description, really, if we want to get it down to its basics, of a view of society in economic terms where people are free to work and to benefit from that work that they do. that they are able to make their own choices in the marketplace rather than having central government legislate for them what they should do. Now, that's how capitalism arose historically. Now, capitalism may have become, in the modern materialistic West, something which for many people has as its end simply profit. But the point I'm trying to make is that that is not fundamental to the development of the notion itself. What is fundamental to it, at a much deeper level, is a view of who we are before God, that we are made with the possibility of developing our own lives, of using the gifts God has given us, and exercising dominion over the world in which He's set us. That is fundamental. You see, in some societies, nothing like capitalism could ever conceivably develop, because you have this set of beliefs which make people in total subjection to their environment, to the spirits, to whatever. But by coming and declaring freedom to people, freedom before God to develop their own life, you're immediately creating the possibility for what we have called capitalism. There are all sorts of other things which go along with it. A sense of hard work, that it's actually worth working. To work hard, you have to believe it's worth working, that you can actually make a difference for your own life and the life of your family, and that it is right to benefit from that. Now, again, that is something which is fundamental to capitalism. But living for money alone or for profit alone is not fundamental to it. It's certainly an essential part of describing what it's become, but it isn't fundamental to it. That's right. Our calling, then, as Christians in this moment of history, is to rescue those biblical notions which are at the heart of it. There's a very helpful book written by Michael Novak. He's a Catholic theologian, called The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism, which is dealing with some of these issues. It has some very remarkable things. He is asking the question in particular, as a historian of economics, why Catholicism didn't produce something different in Latin America, and why Protestantism did produce something different in North America and in Western Europe. And he goes back to the question of saying it's a matter of being faithful to fundamental biblical doctrines, actually. That it was as Calvin and others like him taught God's word really clearly and plainly, that economic reality began to be transformed. Whereas where Christianity is seen as sort of a preservation of the status quo, which it has been in most countries where there's been a state church, where the state and the church have been bound together, the church has become so corrupted by that, it has been simply a force of ideological conservatism. Where it's set free from that, and where there's a real proclamation of the word of God, then you have a tremendous force for change in the economic situation or in any other aspect of the society. But I would say yes. I mean, I'm not interested in defending capitalism as such. I'm interested in and particularly as it's practiced at the moment. See, I think what you've got to recognize is this, that if you look at the development of capitalism as we know it up to the time of Adam Smith, and after Adam Smith, it's really quite different. Because up until the time of Adam Smith, you have an understanding of economic reality which is constrained, first of all, by a sense of obligation to God and accountability to God, secondly, by a recognition of our human possibilities and responsibility, thirdly, by a recognition of human sin, so there need to be restraints. But with the rise of deism, you can look at Adam Smith and Paine, for example, and see that their understanding of capitalism is rather different. Because for them, freedom itself, economically, becomes the primary goal. They don't have a sufficiently deep view, I would say, either of the complexity of this fallen world or of the reality of human sin to see that there need to be judicial restraints on on economic exercise, on employment, on because you have those in the Old Testament law. You have laws about employment. You have laws about justice in relationships. You have laws about loans and interest. You have all kinds of laws which set limits on what you might call the free market. But with Adam Smith, and from that point onwards, you have an understanding of capitalism which has no sense whatsoever of human sin and the need for restraint. And once you forget that human beings are sinful, then you open the door for freedom economically being a goal of its own. And as the Christian view disappears, and the sense of stewardship of the environment disappears, and the sense of accountability to God disappears, what you end up with is a system which can become for many people a kind of idolatry. Just the worship of profit for its own sake, or of power for its own sake. But you have really something which then is set loose from its roots. Which is set loose from its roots. And so I would say the problem isn't with the beast itself. It's what it's become as a non-Christian understanding has shaped its development more and more.